So we're reading today from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 12, and Texts 29 to 30. So on the board is Text 30. So I'll just read 29, the translation. When Krishna entered the mouth of Agasur, the demigods, hidden behind the clouds, exclaimed, "Alas, alas!" But the friends of Agasur, like Kamsa and other demons, were jubilant. And then Text 30. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. When the invincible Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, heard the demigods crying, "Alas, alas," from behind the clouds, he immediately enlarged himself within the demon's throat, just to save himself and the cowherd boys, his own associates, from the demon who wished to smash them. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. It's a very short purport. Such are the acts of Krishna. Paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya cha duskritam. By enlarging himself within the throat of the demon, Krishna suffocated and killed him and at the same time saved himself and his associates from imminent death and also saved the demigods from lamentation. Srila Prabhupada ki. Om Gyanati Mananda Singharajana Shalom. So this is this wonderful pastime of Agasur. And these two verses, we get a little glimpse, not so much of a philosophical detail of a pastime, but more about Krishna and his activities in this world, which can be very confusing. In the preceding verse, Krishna is... Krishna appears as if he's confused. He says, "Now, what was to be done? How could both the killing of this demon and the saving of the devotees be performed simultaneously? Krishna, being unlimitedly potent, decided to wait for an intelligent means by which he could simultaneously save the boys and kill the demon. Then he entered the mouth of Agasur." So Krishna, through these incidents, he's demonstrating what may seem as a little bit of fallibility in terms of his character. Krishna has just seen that Agasur is there. He was a formidable demon, the brother of Putana and Bakasur, I believe. And Agasur is waiting there with his mouth wide open, one lower lip on the ground, higher lip reaching almost the heavenly planets, it's described. And he's making himself appear to be a very attractive place for children to enjoy. So the children rush in there, thinking this is a nice new adventure, we'll get to explore this tunnel. And anyway, even if this is some kind of contraption, some conspiracy, then Krishna will be there and he will save us. So Krishna is happy to accept that command, even though it's not spoken directly to him. He understands the wishes of his cowherd boyfriends. And so he watches them one by one enter this demon, knowing that it's going to be deadly for them. But Agasur somehow keeps his mouth open, because actually the main meal hasn't arrived yet. And he's actually waiting for Krishna. And he wants to finish Krishna off, and possibly also to enjoy him. Because imagine, if Krishna is in your mouth, it must be a very tasty morsel. Well, as Agasur was about to discover, that's not quite the case. There's one other demon whom Krishna killed in a similar manner, and that was Bakasur, as I mentioned. And Bakasur had a large, sharp beak. And this pastime took place just after the killing of Vatsasur, the calf demon. So this calf demon entered amongst Krishna's friends, entered amongst the calves, and tried to act as one of the calves. So Krishna detected this intruder, and with his tail and hind legs, threw this calf, whirled him around a bit, threw him, and killed him. So then Bakasur was there with a fearsomely sharp beak. And Bakasur tried to attack Krishna. And Krishna, he actually swallowed Krishna. So it's described, it just happens very quickly in the pastimes. It says, Bakasur simply with a sharp beak picked up Krishna and swallowed him. And we think, end of story. But sadly, for Bakasur, Krishna became fiery. He became extremely hot, burning. And he burned the throat of Bakasur. And so obviously Bakasur had to spit him out. And then Krishna took the two halves of the beak of Bakasur and bifurcated him. So another gruesome end to a gruesome demon. So why are we taking such, why are we relishing these pastimes with such enjoyment? Seems quite a gruesome set of activities. Well, Krishna responds to the activity with a response that's suitable and fitting for the initial activity. So just as we know that in our spiritual lives, Krishna reciprocates with us according to our desire. As we approach Krishna, as one surrenders to Krishna, so Krishna approaches them. Ye yatha mam prapadyante. So Krishna actually deals with each person according to the mood in which they approach him. So these demons who had come to Vrindavan, these are actually the first few demons that Krishna encounters in Vrindavan. Before that, they were in Gokul. And at that time, the attacks of the demons became so much that they had a Ishtagoshti and decided to move to Vrindavan. So Vatsasura and Bakasura are the first two that demonstrate their prowess in Vrindavan. And then, of course, followed by Agasur, which is the next one that we're discussing today. So as one approaches Krishna, if someone approaches Krishna with great love, with great faith, in a mood of worship, then Krishna deals with them in that spirit also. He takes that person, he gives them the means, he gives them the support, he gives them encouragement to help their spiritual progress, and he reciprocates with them in a very nice way. There are many pastimes like this, especially as the 10th canto proceeds. How Krishna deals with the Krura very nicely, visits his house. He happily gives a lot of mercy to Kubja. There are many persons that Krishna deals with in a very loving reciprocation. He deals with Kamsa in a different manner. Because Kamsa, and these are all of Kamsa's associates, Vatsasur, Bakasur, Agasur, they were all terrible persons who wanted to terrorize the inhabitants of Gokul. They wanted to kill Krishna. They wanted to kill anything and everything dear to Krishna. Kamsa caused so much distress to Yashoda and Nanda Maharaj, Devaki, Vasudev. He caused them all so much trouble. And so, when Krishna has to deal with such persons, he deals with them accordingly. So when a bird comes with a big sharp beak, tries to kill Krishna in that manner, well, Krishna is going to respond in something suitable. He's not going to lodge a complaint in the high court. He's not going to go through an extensive legal process to try to mitigate the situation. He's going to deal with it as required in that moment in time. So in the case of Bakasur, he simply expanded himself, burnt the demon's throat, finished him off. And the cowherd boys were all very happy. For them it was just another adventure with Krishna. And another talking point. And so this theme continues, and with Agasur, they have yet another adventure. Now Agasur was, his service was accepted by Krishna. And that's what's interesting. That the mouth Agasur kept open, he provided some level of pleasure to the inhabitants of Vraja. The boys had some fun. They went inside that mouth, they played around. Krishna actually acted to please the Lord and his associates in some way. So in one sense, we quote Agasur sometimes as an example of Kripa Siddha, one who attains perfection by mercy of the Lord. He's quoted in that way. Because we know that when Agasur was finally killed, that it was seen that his life form merged into the body of Krishna. He achieved a form of Sayuja Mukti, which is a very interesting result for someone who's very inimical. So Krishna deals with people sometimes in a very externally powerful way, but he also always gives them something that's way beyond anything they deserve. To get that kind of treatment would require a great deal of tapasya, austerity, efforts. And even then, it's not really possible to obtain the actual mercy of Krishna through any of these methods in themselves. Krishna awards his glory, Krishna awards his mercy as and when he sees fit. So devotees, when they try to achieve the favor of Krishna, they try to seek the favor of his devotees, others dear to him, and then they hope that Krishna will bestow upon them his mercy. So Agasur pleased the Lord somehow, just as Putana had done earlier. Even though her intention was to kill Krishna, she still wanted to feed him. She still wanted to render some service to him. So she did, and Krishna accepted that. So Agasur allowed all these cowherd boys to come in. Krishna then entered within. Krishna followed. Finally, Agasur got the preparation he was waiting for. He was waiting for the dessert all along. And Krishna went inside, and he saw this is actually a terrible situation. So then actually what happens next is subject for the next few classes. But there is this moment which comes before the rest of this pastime. And that takes place in today's verses, that Krishna appears to be contemplating. He seems to be a little confused, that my friends have disappeared, there's this big demon here, now what should I do? If I kill the demon, there's a good chance that my friends will die also. So what is to be done? So this is the dilemma that Krishna has. And of course Krishna has multiple purposes to fulfill with any of these pastimes. So this Agasura was also a great troublemaker for the demigods. So they were all also extremely afraid when they saw that he had appeared on the scene and that all the cowherd boys at this stage had been swallowed. So they were in a very frightful condition. So Krishna has this complex situation to deal with. Now we could ask sometimes perhaps that this indicates that Krishna isn't maybe as great as he is portrayed. I mean, after all, he should know the answer just like this. He should have an instant response to any situation. Well, yes, that is there. Krishna certainly deals with every situation competently. But Krishna also likes to have a good pastime. It's not in his interests. Krishna, all these adventures, all these things don't happen outside of Krishna's control. Normally when we are in distress, we want the distressful situation to end as quickly as possible. If there is some great problem in our lives, we would just like it to be over quickly. If we have some medical issue, we would just like the doctors to just sort it out quickly. But none of the problems that happen to the residents of Raja, or to Krishna, to Balaram, or to anyone, none of them happen through the agency of external control, through the agency of material nature, through the laws of karma and reaction. None of the things that are happening are due to factors outside of Krishna's control. So every single incident that happens, every moment for pause, every seeming moment of dissatisfaction or seeming moment of bewilderment, it all happens for the sake of a special lila. And therefore we have to be very careful if we try to take aspects of Krishna's leelas and draw an immediate parallel with our own lives. That can be dangerous sometimes. Because these situations happening here, especially these pastimes, they are not normal. They are out of the ordinary. There are these demons who are definitely qualified in a way that no one else is today. They're very strong, very powerful, very deadly. No one comes close to them in today's day and age. We're horrified by different stories, different reports we hear of people who've done horrendous things. But these persons were far more horrendous, far more extensively powerful than the ones we hear about. So Krishna, he wants to enjoy a pastime. So as part of that, he creates a whole scene. Now if you watch a drama, if you participate in theater, watch a movie, it's actually an art. How to create a whole scenario and take the audience through a whole set of emotions and feelings and situations to build up to a certain point and maybe multiple points so that a certain dramatic effect is achieved. So Krishna does the same. And as part of that, Krishna sometimes has to give up his omniscience, his omnipresence, his higher powers for the sake of those pastimes to take place. So we know on a high level that all these pastimes are arranged for Krishna's desire. But in order to relish those pastimes at the time itself, at that moment, Krishna has to act as an ordinary person. And he does this with Mother Yashoda, with Nanda Maharaj. He happily acts as a young child. He carries Nanda Maharaj's shoes on his head. Now imagine someone asking the Supreme Personality of Godhead to do that. Sridharma, he's simply waiting for Krishna to carry him on his back. He prepares himself to have a big wrestling match with Krishna. Now who can actually do that and get away? When Kamsa tries a little later, with Chanura, Mushtika and all these other persons, Krishna doesn't stand for it too much. He finishes them off fairly quickly. But all these personalities who Krishna engages in pastimes with, they have so much fun. Mother Yashoda binds Krishna. He allows her to do that. So he removes himself from a position of complete power for the sake of engaging in a pastime. So Krishna here appears to contemplate. He appears to be confused. And through that, he actually gets to give delight to people. It also then becomes another talking point. So sometimes we wonder that in some of these pastimes, a pastime which isn't too dreadful. It does happen quite quickly, this pastime. But there are others where it seems that Krishna puts his devotees through a great deal of trouble just for the sake of a pastime before he actually deals with the situation. There are pastimes later with forest fires, before actually forest fires, that happens on multiple occasions. There are pastimes where Krishna enters into the abode of Varuna to rescue Nanda Maharaj. There are all these pastimes which take place, some of which give a great deal of anxiety, fear, dread to all those inhabitants, to all his associates. So sometimes we wonder, okay, this is Krishna having a pastime, but why does he do this? Can't he just have a pastime which is just fun from beginning to end? Why do all his family members constantly have to be struggling? Why do they have to be in constant anxiety? Mother Yashoda, it's constantly anxiety. What will Krishna do next? Which demon will attack Krishna next? What are these two boys going to do next? They're always up to so much mischief, Krishna, Balaram and all the cowherd boys. So this is, in one sense, a source of great pleasure and a source of great anxiety. So, even though seemingly externally that these are very troublesome stages for someone to go through, they actually, on the spiritual platform, also give a great deal of enjoyment and taste to the participants. Now, we can't fully comprehend those, because some of them come in the secondary rasas, or the complementary rasas, the indirect rasas as described in the Nectar of Devotion. We know obviously, the five primary rasas, those loving exchanges which we hear about as the primary interactions, conjugal rasa, friendship, parental, etc. Then there are also these seven indirect interactions that can take place. And some of them involve fear, dread, ghastliness. Now in the material world, these appear to be really unpalatable. No one likes a situation of dread where you don't know what's going to happen next. No one likes to be fearful. When there's a situation which you can best describe as ghastly, you want to escape from it as quickly as possible. Now in the spiritual world, although these similar concepts are used, in fact they are the original concepts from the spiritual world, the result is completely different. Because all of these act as means by which the audience or the participants in that leela have their emotions churned to build them up for a greater experience. It's a wonderful and somewhat inconceivable situation. Krishna puts devotees through all this trouble just so they experience something wonderful. And it's not just a quick experience, it then becomes, as I mentioned, a topic of conversation thereafter. So we hear constantly that Rohini, Devaki, Mother Yashoda, especially in Vrindavan, Yashoda, Nanda Maharaj, the gopis, Krishna's pastimes, Krishna's antics, Krishna's troubles become a source of their conversation for days, for hours. And the great sages have described that the talk of the gopis, of Krishna, in some cases their expression of great distress at having lost Krishna when Krishna leaves Vrindavan, that talk is sweeter, as Uddhava describes, that talk is sweeter than the perfectly pronounced hymns of the sages. So that discussion of Krishna's pastimes is yet another fallout from the Leela. And we're very grateful that we have all these pastimes, that Krishna has done all these things, so that we have some good topics to discuss. As soon as we allow these topics to enter into our consciousness, we give ourselves a little relief from all the day-to-day struggles, issues, headaches, agendas that plague every single person in this world. So the more we absorb these topics about Krishna, the more we meditate on those pastimes, the more we are confused, why does Krishna do this? The more we wonder, how does he do this? Why does he do this? The more fun we have. And the better and better we feel in devotional service. Because these pastimes are what actually give us relishable taste. Krishna performs his pastimes, he appears to disappear sometimes. That's the next stage of his pastimes. He disappears, he does something else. But then that pastime is kept alive in the hearts of the devotees through their discussion. And this is why the devotees are so very important. It is described in the Vedic literatures that the shastras contain a large amount of information, and they contain a large number of details of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And they contain arguments and counter-arguments on practically every point. And so every single person can attempt to extract something which appeals to them from a certain part of the Shastra to perhaps promote or serve the particular agenda that's going on in their mind. So that will always be possible. But actually, what is recommended, or the lesson that we're meant to extract from this, is that the best benefit we can achieve from a process of spiritual progress is to actually take shelter of the advanced devotees, in whose hearts the pastimes of Krishna are constantly going round. Krishna is alive in the hearts of his devotees when they constantly meditate on his pastimes. And then they become, simply because of the presence of Krishna within their hearts, they become the touchstones of spiritual life. So there's a nice Vedic aphorism, I think it's in the Mahabharata also, Achintya kaluye bhavana tam starkena yojayet. So this explains that which is inconceivable cannot be ascertained by logic and reasoning. Now for some people this can come as a shock, because they think, I'm going to understand and I'm going to advance in spiritual life on the basis of my intellectual capacity, on the basis of all my facilities, on the basis of whatever I have or have done, which appears to be great. They think these will be the guiding forces that will propel me through spiritual life. Whatever someone happens to be good at, they may think this is what will help me. However, Shastra says that logic, reasoning, argumentation is not the process for understanding the personality of the Lord. It cannot actually be done. That which is inconceivable, as Krishna is, his nature is inconceivable, himself he is inconceivable, sometimes to himself, that's another discussion, but he is that person who bewilders everyone. He bewilders the demigods, Muyanti Yatsureya, as is described in the Bhagavatam. And so his inconceivable nature can never be reduced to a set of tasks. to a set of activities. One activity now, another activity later, perhaps spread out over many years. It really does depend simply on Krishna's mercy. And when we actually imbibe this point, that something that is inconceivable can only come by the mercy of Krishna and his devotees, that is when we actually make advancement. Now that doesn't mean that our logic, our reasoning, our intelligence, our faculties, our good sense, that they are all rejected in spiritual pursuits. No, they also have a very important part to play. It is actually a sign of great intelligence that someone accepts that there is God. That is actually an intelligent conclusion if someone considers all the factors, all the parameters available. If someone considers how at every stage in scientific exploration, someone is discovering that there appears to be a design here, that there appears to be a purpose. Simply that little consideration can lead one to question about the designer. I always find it amusing how sometimes when people speak about evolution, evolution theory, how all the species evolved, they try to explain certain traits that animals or creatures have by saying, this creature evolved in order to do this. That itself is such a contradiction in a sentence. They say, this creature has developed big claws in order to help it to do this. But the fact is that you are saying this creature evolved randomly from a series of other random organisms, and this creature has appeared randomly there, and somehow you're now connecting a purpose to some of its faculties, facilities, and activities. That doesn't make sense. So similarly, we can apply whatever little level of intelligence we have to simply looking at the reality of the world, looking at the extent of the creation, looking at how elaborate it is, how vast it is, how carefully designed it is, then actually coming to some kind of conclusion, or at least a topic for exploration, that there may well be a designer behind this, Sri Sri Radha Gokulanand Ki, that there may well be a very competent person with a very large brain who has designed this, that may actually be a very intelligent conclusion. And then as we go through spiritual life, we also use our intelligence to assist us. Our mind, intelligence, senses, when they are carefully controlled through the practices in the Gita, through the principles that we follow, they actually assist us to receive the mercy of the Lord on a daily basis. So all of these things are important, but we have to place them in their right order, order of priority and order of potency. The highest potency is to receive the mercy of Krishna, to please his devotees. Only then can we understand why is Krishna confused? Why does he treat the gopis like this? Why does he give so much anxiety to Maharaj Nanda? Why does he give such pain to Agasur? It's not a very nice thing to do, to bifurcate someone, to kill someone. Why does he give such pain to Bakasur? These things we can only understand when we get to know the personality of Krishna. We can never do them through logic and reasoning. So logic, reasoning, education can hopefully bring us to the point where we accept that there is a supreme person. That there is a supreme person and that there is order, there is design. There are greater systems at work than the ones under our control. But then to understand who that person is, what he likes, what he dislikes, what does he do, where does he live, who are his friends, to understand all of these things requires mercy. Requires mercy and revelation from Krishna, within the heart and externally. So those are a few points that struck me from this section of Agasura. We'll obviously hear about exactly how the pastime takes place and what happens next. And then there's a wonderful leela, of course, coming after that with Lord Brahma. And then this pastime is recounted a year later as part of that whole scene. But I'll stop there and maybe I'll ask if there are any questions, comments. Yes, Taruna Prabhu, and then Vishwambar Prabhu.
Hare Krishna Prabhu. You just mentioned towards the end of how way Krishna kills demons, and there's so much gore and so much. There's something which in my mind I can't reconcile at all, because we have logic, you know, there's something human in us, compassion, and especially those people who are spiritual and they read these pastimes. Krishna doesn't kill the demons but tortures them, you know, it's like. So just wondering, is it any way you have some realization how to accept that way of dealing with demons or anyone else, and how to explain something when you rebel, you know, like, you know, spiritual life should be cheesy.
Yes.
But it is too cruel. It just indulges. Seems to me it's bloodthirsty and it likes to torture or something, you know.
Yes, that's a very good question, and that's the point I was touching on earlier. That yes, Krishna kills the demons in a very dramatic way. Now imagine, when Krishna, first of all, Krishna has an adventure. The demons do some pretty horrendous things to Krishna. Then Krishna kills them in the way most suitable for them. Now it can seem gruesome, but it's reciprocation. If someone attacks Krishna, they should be ready for an attack back. They can't get on a moral high seat and say, why don't you deal with me or treat me very nicely? I want to kill you. You know, I've got some ferocious weapons. I've got all the means at my disposal to cause you great harm. In fact, my intention is to cause you great harm. So should we stand back very carefully, very calmly? And should that person have the right to say, you should treat me now in a certain way? It's interesting. I'm not sure it's the right of an antagonist to demand a particular type of treatment from the person they are harming. They should be grateful for getting any kind of treatment. Now, actually, Krishna... So in a sense, your concern is actually... It is actually addressed by Krishna, but not in the way we think. So Krishna does actually do something for the benefit of all these people. Because obviously in the back of our minds, in everyone's minds, there's probably this concept that sometimes people make mistakes. Sometimes people do something wrong. And if you give them harsh treatment, then you yourself may be lowering your own standards of morality and actual standards of etiquette and behavior. Just because someone does something to us doesn't mean we have to respond in the same way. So as we hear famously, Jesus Christ, turn the other cheek. So yes, that is also one of the tools Krishna employs. Now, it is not the case that Krishna simply finishes off all the miscreants who attack him and his devotees in this same manner. There are other situations. There is a situation of Ashwatthama. When he killed the five sleeping sons of Draupadi. Now that's a heinous crime by any standards. Killing children is completely in a league worse than killing adults. At least it is assumed that children are innocent and they should be freed from this type of behavior. So certainly in Vedic culture, if anyone harms children, that is very deadly. In that situation, it was not appropriate to kill the antagonist because there were other mitigating factors. So in that case, some outcome was achieved in such a way that the person was killed in one sense, but not actually killed physically. So Krishna dealt with that in that way. In this particular case, Agasur has come in the spirit of Bakasur and others, who he's actually fighting on their behalf, on behalf of Kamsa. He's very upset that these two persons were killed by Krishna when they attacked Krishna. So he has now come to do something very deadly. So Krishna is giving him a type of reciprocation which befits his strength. On the battlefield, Bhishma Dev, although he ended up on the wrong side, he attacked Krishna in a chivalrous spirit. And I was speaking about these secondary rasas. So that's one of them, the rasa of chivalry, where one actually adopts a fighting mood with the Lord. Now that's different to the fighting mood adopted by Agasur. That is a fighting mood which is meant for the Lord's pleasure. So when Bhishma Dev on the battlefield attacked him with arrows, caused him some wounds on his body, Krishna accepted that, it's described, as the greatest offering. Because Bhishma Dev was fighting with him in a certain spirit of chivalry. And Bhishma Dev was his great devotee. So Krishna was very happy to have that. But Krishna in reciprocation, what did Krishna do? Krishna didn't just do nothing. Krishna also charged at Bhishma Dev. He reciprocated with Bhishma Dev in the manner that Bhishma Dev was approaching him. So he charged at Bhishma Dev. And he was about to attack Bhishma Dev, part of that rasa. Now that's actually attacking, fighting is, there's a certain competitive ecstasy there. The original competition happens when Krishna engages in wrestling with his cowherd friends, his cowherd boyfriends. They derive a great deal of pleasure through that process. Now we get a little perverted reflection. Even in this world, it is actually a very common phenomenon that people like to watch a good fight. Sad to say, but it's a fact. The boxing ring, there's so many different wrestling, programs that have been produced. World Wrestling Federation, so many other things. Different types of competitive sports which people know, which people do. And so people are always trying to compete. Sports, Olympics, it's all about competition. So this is a nature, this is a part of human spirit. Competitive nature, fighting, wrestling, it's there. So within each forum there are rules. So if someone is in a boxing ring and one person pulls out a gun and shoots the other person, that wouldn't be really accepted by the judges. That wouldn't really be okay as part of that sport. They're expected to respond in the appropriate manner, with their fists, with some punches. With Agasur, the playground is different. It's not a boxing match. It's not a high court. This is a forest where the children are playing. They're having fun. This great demon has come. He's trying to kill them. So they're going to deal with that situation in the appropriate means. So Krishna chooses a certain means for each situation. Imagine it would be really boring if all the pastimes went like this. Demon A attacked Krishna and his friends. Then Krishna arrested the demon, called the police. The police came, it went to court, and he was handed a life sentence. That doesn't create much conversation amongst the gopis. That doesn't create much enjoyment for generations of people thereafter. But there's this other little edge to it as well, that these people get the result which they could never have obtained by even pacifying Krishna through great austerities, through spiritual practice. It is extremely unlikely for any of them to get the result that Krishna actually gives them. So he does finish them off in a very spectacular, visible, gruesome way sometimes. But he gives them a result which is well beyond their expectations, well beyond their reasonable expectations. So there are some parts of the Gita, some parts of our Shastras, where Krishna directly demonstrates through his own behavior how we should behave. But there are other parts where we are expected to use discretion and guidance from the acharyas in understanding how they apply to our life. We have to understand Krishna's actual position. So this is obviously a big topic. There's much more we could churn on this. But There's a few indications there.